No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-671-6008. I'm sorry, 888-627-6008. You'd think after I've said it 1,000 times, I would have memorized the number. Tonight we have a very special guest, Professor Boughton from the University of Maryland, my alma mater. We're excited to speak to him, and just to give you a little background, he's an associate professor at the University of Maryland, and he was an observer at the Stop the Steal rally, or insurrection, depending on your opinion, on January 6th here in the District of Columbia. He teaches courses on the American Revolution, the Constitution, the early national period, and the Atlantic revolutions of the late 18th to mid-19th century. His research examines the meaning and practice of democracy during the era of the American Revolution, and he has a book called Taming Democracy, The People, the Founders, and the Troubled Ending of the American Revolution. I mean, I could talk to this man all day because I'm interested in all this, but mostly I'm interested right now in if you can put what happened last Wednesday in context for us. So welcome to the show, Professor Boughton. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, you were there. Let's start right at the beginning of what happened on Wednesday. You were there as an observer.
My wife and I went down. My wife is an avid photographer, and we had attended a lot of the other protests of the Trump era, starting with the Women's March in January 2017, and you know, like the Science March and the March for Science, and a number of the other protests there. We had gone to those as participants, and she had taken a lot of pictures, and then so she was thinking about. You know, this is the end of the Trump era. She was trying to put together a whole, like, you know, just book for herself of her photography over the era. And so, you know, we'll just go to this one. And I was very reluctant to go because, of course, I was concerned about security. I was aware of lots of threats of violence, and knew, you know, a number of the alt-right groups were going to be there and be prominently there. And so I was really afraid of that. But she's like, you know, it's D.C. D.C. knows, you know, does protests. They know protests. Right. Every other protest we had been to had considerable security presence. You know, even the March for Science with Bill Nye had a, you know, pretty sizable presence. And so we figured for this one where I don't know how you were not aware that there wasn't threats of violence just from paying attention to basic social media. You know, if you hung out on Twitter, you knew that had been promised. I was reluctant to go, but she convinced me that there would be a big presence. We'd just hang back, and if there was anything, you know, if it got real violent, we'd get out of there. So we got there late. We got there around 2, just as they, drove down from Baltimore and went to the Union Station garage and then walked down Delaware Street over. And, you know, we passed Senate Park on the way, and there was a permitted stage there and sound system, and some guy was on the mic going off about how, you know, listing the crimes against humanity by Anthony Fauci. And it was, you know, it was pretty clear we were entering a different world. We got to the Capitol about shortly after the rioters had breached the building. And one of the first places we hit was that kiosk on Delaware where there's the plates that rise up and down. And the Capitol police officer there said that they told us they had breached the Capitol. She said, you might not want to go much further. And, you know, we hung out there for a little while. We saw the Capitol police, about 10 Capitol police officers putting on riot gear to go into the tunnels, into the Capitol. And then we left there and walked around to the back lawn. We went to the back of the Capitol. Most of what we saw was on the back side of the Capitol. But we were there. We saw people coming out who had just been tear gassed. We saw all the crowds there. You know, the police on the backside, whatever. We ended up getting pretty close to the, right up against the Capitol at one point in time. So we were right there. We were there for about 3 hours.
Well, let me ask you the difference. And by the way, we have Maria with us now. We had a little technical difficulty at the beginning of the show. But let me ask you, since you were at the Women's March, and there were lots of mad people at the Women's March, and you were at this march, and there were lots of mad people there, angry people. Was the difference that security was different? Was that the big difference that you saw, that there was more security at the Women's March than there was at this march?
Oh, there's far, far, far more security at the Women's March than there was at this march.
Wow.
There was, on the Women's March, you had to go through metal detectors to get in. I mean, it was like a million people. It was... there are all kinds of rules about what you could and couldn't take. Like, you know, there's no body armor, no weapons, nothing to conceive of weapons. You couldn't bring backpacks in. You could only have a clear backpack. There were all kinds of limitations on what you could give and couldn't give. So. So we were surprised to see people at this march just completely like body armor all over the place. People in their, you know, weekend commando outfits. So that was really surprising, and having not just, we didn't see weapons, but people had sticks, you know, like that they had flags on, and a lot of those sticks were sharpened into basically like spears. So there was a lot of that, and there was I don't think, you know, the thing that struck me about the Women's March, like there were people who were angry there, but this was like a million people basically shoulder to shoulder, and like. But being all friends, people were very friendly. They were very polite. There weren't people screaming and yelling, and no calls for violence and the rest of that. As opposed to the riot. There's like so much violent rhetoric and anger coming out. I described it as it was like a jubilant anger. Like it's just, you know, mm-hmm. like they were excited and geared up, but also, you know, but very angry. And you saw that everywhere, and you saw that out of every kind of person who was there. The crowd represented a true cross section of the Republican Party, which wasn't the initial impression, given that the media was really focusing on that, you know, like the Proud Boys and the, you know, the guy in the, you know, Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt with the
right.
with the, you know, Duck Dynasty beard and the. You know, the guy in the Viking hat, you know, that was the impression, was that these are sort of these, you know, out of the mainstream kinds of people. But the people we saw, you know, the vast majority of people there were very much like middle-aged, middle-class, you know, upper middle class, upper middle class. And that was, it was people's aunts and uncles and their brothers and sisters and brothers-in-laws. And, you know, it was, you know, your neighbor. It was, you know, people who worked in real estate firms. It was developers. It was like, oh, it was, you know, as we know from the, you know, one of the things that's sort of my initial observations is a lot of what we found out from people who have been arrested since and who have been identified since is it was exactly that. It was very much a middle class, upper middle class, like white people. Like they weren't exclusively white, but it was 90 whatever percent white.
Yeah. Maria, You want to ask a question?
And I'm sorry. There were Skype issues. I apologize. And Dr. Bouton, am I saying your name correctly?
Bouton.
Hi, Dr. Bouton. Since your research puts into perspective meaning and practice of democracy, specifically during the American Revolution, can you take us from that lens that you put on the American Revolution to what you saw on January 6th?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the closest parallel for me, I wrote a book about the first insurrection against the United States government in 1794, the so-called Whiskey Rebellion. And while there are clear differences, right? I mean, in 1794, these farmers that I wrote about in the Revolutionary War had faced state and eventually federal policies that were had really decimated their economy and made their lives very difficult. You know, in a decade, 40% of them had been foreclosed. So they had like genuine, real, searing grievances. Whereas the modern case seems to be a lot of, you know, upper middle class, you know, bigotry wrapped in conspiracy theory. But what it was similar about the two was a belief that their cause was just, and that they represented the true revolution, and that when push came to shove, the people were going to rise and join them, right? They represented the people, and the people were going to rise up and join them. So in 1794, when they rise up and they find out that, you know, George Washington has called out the army to come, and there's a, you know, 10 to 12,000 army marching against them, that they talk of, you know, why are we going to fight? And they say that they you know, come close to fighting, or they vote because the ones who want to go to war say that, you know, when they come, they're going to turn against you. They'll put down, they either won't come, but when they come, they're going to put down their guns, or else they're going to turn around and join us and go against the government. And they were convinced that that was what was going to happen. And you see the same thing on January 6th in the Capitol insurrection, that you saw these people coming in convinced that they are the revolution, right? The number of times we heard there are people talking about this is 1776 and this was the revolution. You could hear it on all, you know, inside the Capitol, outside the Capitol, that there was a real sense of themselves as revolutionaries. They referred to themselves as patriots constantly. We were greeted as patriots on a number of occasions. And so there is this sense, and also that sense of entitlement, like the police were going to join them, like law enforcement was going to turn around and join them. And when law enforcement didn't do that, right, I mean, we know that there are examples of members of the Capitol Police who seem to have been working with them in some way or complicit or whatever. But, you know, all the people we saw outside and around on the Capitol Police Force were trying to do their jobs. We're clearly disturbed by what was happening and frightened by what was happening. And we saw when they did do their jobs like that, the crowd turned on them, that they got in the faces of these people, screaming at them sometimes, telling them, you know, we had your back in the summer when the Black Lives Matter protests were on, and now you need to have our back, right? We had your back, now you need to have ours. We heard some version of that kind of thing, like, we had your back, now you need to have ours, like, all day. Go ahead.
No, I'll go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, it was just, there was that, you know, and when, for example, after Ashley Babbitt was shot, then you started to hear a lot of people shouting, especially at the police, and calling them traitors and murderers. And these people, bear in mind, these people all, like, many of them had the Thin Blue Line flag. Like, there were about as many Thin Blue Line flags as there were American flags. And there was one guy who was standing on, I'm pretty sure he's a Proud Boy. He was in one of the other videos. I've seen him in a couple of the other videos. But he was standing on the top of the back Capitol steps, and he starts ripping up the Thin Blue Line flag and letting the, you know, the shards of the flag flutter over the crowd. And it starts, you know, some people start chanting, you know, F the police and F the blue. And there was some guy at one point who was standing right next to my wife, and turned, she was filming something, and he turns and gets like in front of the camera and starts like speechifying about the police, like basically saying they're not our friends, you know, they're the muscle of the government, they're here to take our guns away and put our children in concentration camps. And like, that's part of the sentiment we sort of heard all over, this very dicey, uneasy relationship with the police, where they were, you know, supported the police as long as the police were willing to support them, and once the police didn't, then of course they, you know, they turned on them.
And is this, let me ask you, I mean, the thing you talk about where you say these people consider themselves patriots and they thought the police were on their side, is this always part of revolution? I know that, for example, I did some research on the Lincoln assassination when I was in college, and this was exactly what John Wilkes Booth thought, right? He thought he was going to shoot Lincoln and the South was going to rise up and support him, and he was kind of shocked that he didn't get support in the end. So was this always an element that
society. I mean, I think it's just part of misinformation and rumor and the power of rumor, especially when it's mixed up with political violence, and people who are being clearly ginned up ahead of time for this, you know, that, like, put it this way, look, there were a lot of people there who had intentionality, right? Who were there for violence. Like, they had strapped up for violence. They had put on their body armor, and they had put, you know, there were a lot of people wearing firearm shields. So, like, if they went up against the Capitol Police, they could put their arm out and block the blow from a billy club. There's a lot of that. I mean, these guys were dressed for siege. But most of the people there were not. And a number of the people we saw who had been inside the Capitol, like who were gassed, you know, who got pepper sprayed, were not dressed for violence. Like, there was one guy I saw, the first guy I saw who'd been pepper sprayed, he was nicely dressed. He was wearing a sweater with a Duke emblem on it, Duke University emblem. And it was like an alumni sweater, not, you know, Duke basketball swag. Like, this was something you would wear if you were an alumni. And so this guy's there. And there's people, you know, with North Face jackets and Under Armour backpacks and the rest. It was really upper middle class kinds of people who many of them were not, you know, there were people like that who were dressed in camo and had helmets on and padding and the rest, you know, and came with gas masks. But most of the people didn't. And they seemed to have been clearly radicalized as part of this, you know, the rally and the rest, and you know, join the crowds in storming in. And that's
because
the real frightening part.
I was saying recently, who could afford to travel to D.C. on a work day, even if you're working from home, and pay for lodging and show up other than people who have means?
Yeah. Well,
some mastermind behind this that was doling out allowances or stipends or something.
Yeah, no, and we saw that too. You can see that in, like, on the way back to the Union Station garage, we passed by a bunch of there's a number of, like, boutique-y hotels. I can't remember what street they're on, but, like, the George is one of them, and then there's another one right next door. Well, these ones all had the lobby. I mean, they were all, like, the lobbies were filled with people in, like, you know, MAGA gear. And,
really?
Oh yeah, and they were none of them were wearing masks. They were well dressed. They were drinking wine, and they were, you know, they were having cocktails in the lobby, and they were all like giddy and looking at their phones and sharing pictures and looking at the news. Now, whereas when we got home, we looked at the news and we were like horrified by what had happened inside. We had no concept of what was going on inside. But these people saw that, right? They saw the violent entrances and whatever the footage that was released the first day. And they were thrilled by it. You know, that to me was the real, it was the casualness of casual embrace of violence by seemingly, you know, mild-mannered looking people, you know, middle, upper middle class kind of people, without any sense of the consequences. I mean, the kind of the entitlement running around the Capitol that day was pretty astonishing. Like, you know, and it started with the march over. We saw, I mean, I didn't see this, but we were up there too. But so I wrote this thing up on Twitter and it went viral. And then after that, I got a email from a professor at College Park. I teach at UMBC in Baltimore, and he was at College Park, Maryland, and he sent me sent me some video. He said he didn't have a Twitter feed but wanted me to post this video for him. And he had some really chilling clips of the start of the march from the White House to the Capitol, where the march is led by the far-right groups. Like, the Proud Boys are right up front, and a number of the people you can see in the videos inside the Capitol, who are some of the ringleaders, were up front. And they start the march to the Capitol by saying, right, whose streets are streets? Whose streets are streets? And then they start the march. Inside the Capitol, these people were chanting, right, whose house, our house? And so you get a clear sense of the entitlement here, and the, you know, that, and I got the feeling from people, like, they just didn't think, they thought that they were going to be heroes. They thought that they were revolutionaries, and this was 1776, and their names were going to be in textbooks one day, and that there weren't going to be consequences, and if there were, you know, Donald Trump would get them out of it.
Apparently, some of those arrested have been asking for a pardon.
Well, yeah, of course. It doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, the thing that most surprised me on that day was that we started talking about this, but then was the largely absent law enforcement presence. And right when we got there, there was a pretty, like, we never knew how bad it was inside. We never had any inkling of how bad it was inside, because it's D.C. And if both houses of Congress were in session and the vice president was there, and what happened inside, why weren't there SWAT teams there immediately? Like, we saw one SWAT team, right? Our first picture we have, like, was timestamped at 12:12. Our last one was at 2:12 p.m. And the last one was at 5:09 p.m. And so, and there's no police in these pictures, or very few. Like, the FBI we saw was an 8 to 10 person, what I'm assuming was a SWAT team. And they were only there to get Ash back. That was it. And once they got her out, they left.
The
reinforcements we saw were Capitol Police. We didn't see any Metro Police in the back.
Well, and one of the amazing things about the Capitol Police presence is I've been arrested by the Capitol Police in front of the Senate. And I can tell you, they're very, very good at it. And one of the things they do is they overwhelm you. You know,
right.
I remember
exactly.
When I was arrested in front of the Senate, they were really polite about it. They were like, please put your hands behind your back, Senator. You know, let me know if this is too tight and all that kind of stuff. But when I stood up, there were five big police officers standing around me. Like,
right.
Make no mistake about it, pal. We're taking you to jail, and, you know, and that's that.
Well, Michael, so wait a really second, though. Give context to our listeners about why you were being arrested.
I was being arrested because the Senate was interfering with local health policy in the District of Columbia. They were trying to take health benefits away from women, poor women, and we felt that they couldn't do this in any other state. They could only do it in Washington, D.C., because they have control over the district. So there were three or four of us. There was a series of week-long protests, and I was in one of them. Just to tell you the end of the story, the judge that we came before said to me, "You're my hero. I admire people that stand up for their beliefs, but even heroes can't sit in the middle of the damn street. You're
right.
Guilty." and they charged me $100. So even if you're a hero, you can't block traffic. But yeah, but that's
you know, the presence, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even when you walk in, you know this, Professor, when you walk in to the Senate or the House, you walk to a very narrow area through a metal detector where there are three or four cops. There's not like one security guy there. There's a group of people that are there to handle whatever situation might come. So that was very, very strange. And I think we'll find out in the long run whether you know, they were told to stand down or not.
Yeah,
They, you know, everybody's talking about future violence. Was this like the first act? Was this like the Boston Tea Party? And there's going to be, you know, you can see a continuation of this. This was a shot across the bow, you think, or this was just the final frustration of these people over the election?
I don't think it's the final frustration. I mean, I think that we misrepresent it if we think it's just about the election and just about Trump. Because, I mean, you look at the look at the polling. Like, these people aren't budging on their beliefs or their sense of themselves as being, you know, on the right side of things. Even after all that footage has come out, even after we've learned all of the about the deaths of the police inside and the. You know, I think my you know, broader perspective on this, historical perspective, this is sort of the last gasp of why this is so dangerous right now. I think why these people are so riled up, why they're willing to take these kinds of steps and this kind of use this kind of political violence and threaten more. And I think it's because this is kind of the last gasp, the last stand of a kind of white supremacy, right? Of white privilege, of you know, they know demographically the United States is changing. They're not going to, right? And that's part of the reason for trying to suppress every other vote, because white people are going to be in the minority population, and they're not, you know, and the generations that are coming down the pike, with, you know, with the millennials and the as Gen Z starts, more of them become voting age. They're tolerant, you know. They're multicultural.
Right.
They're very different. They're not going to put up with that kind of stuff. And so I think that there's a real sense, which you hear in a lot of the rhetoric, right? You know, that you will not replace us. Jews will not replace us. This is it's anti-Semitism, but it's anti-Semitism in a sense of they're going to lose. Like they're making a stand, and that's. I think what makes it so dangerous right now is because, you know, I don't think it's about. I think Trump was very important to, as a rallying point, but I think Trump was a rallying point. Trump was a symptom of a larger problem, and I don't think it's going to go away easily. I don't think it's going to, you know, result in. I hope it doesn't result in mass violence. Although, you know, in a lot of my big, you know, the big worry is in these open carry states,
right?
Like Michigan and Virginia, where, right. You know, where things could get, if things get violent, it could, you know, the body counts could get pretty high pretty quick, because of how heavily armed everybody is. But I think actually one of the things that can put the brakes on this is the fact that it is a middle class and upper middle class revolution, you know, or movement or whatever you want to call it, in that these are people who I don't think have a clear sense of consequences for their actions. I mean, the bewildered look and the tantrums thrown when these people are getting outed and arrested and losing their jobs and, you know, the crying, kicking and screaming that goes on. I mean, there's a lot of like white victimhood going on here and a lot of entitlement that goes in with it. And so these are people who have things to lose, right? They have good jobs and they have clients and customers and small businesses. And they're exactly the kinds of people, like comfortable middle-class people who penalties will work for, you know, consequences will work for. Like, I don't think consequences, even prison, is going to derail a lot of the Proud Boys and the hardcore white nationalists. But a lot of these, like, QAnon people and other folks who are deep into some delusion, you know, like, lose your job, and that's going to be a pretty big wake-up call, and or at least a deterrent to violence by others. But you know, but I worry, too. I got it. One of the things we observed, like, once when we got home, and this is actually even more recently, like this week. So my wife took a lot of pictures. We took video. We got home, uploaded it all to the FBI. And then, you know, we posted some of it online. And then as we started to, as news came out, that this thing was more and more, like, it was clear that it was planned, and it was clear that it was pretty meticulously planned. We started to go back over some of the, like, we started to reconsider some of the kind of odd things we saw, which we didn't quite know how to place, or were just kind of weird, and we didn't think about them too much at the time, because there was so much else to think about, like the basics of what had happened. But in retrospect, looking back and taking a look over some of these pictures, we started to notice that, like, we started to guess, you know, my wife was like, I wonder if, like, how much of some of what we saw, especially with, like, that, the outrage, like, some of that was manufactured, or there were people who were there to pump up the crowd in different ways. And so for example, there were kind of like circles of people who would form, and some of these sort of ringleader Proud Boy types would get in there and just start shouting and yelling and clearly trying to whip up the crowd. And I haven't done the timing of this video yet, but one of the videos that was just released, that long one that was just released, the New Yorker one, yeah, today, I don't know if you've seen it. It's pretty distressing. But oh, there's one guy inside who, when they're going in at one point in time, looks around and takes a look at the crowd and says, there's not enough of us, right? There's not enough of us. They're going to come in and take it. So he goes back. He goes the opposite direction of the crowd. And when we were out back, one of the things that they were doing to try to, I'm pretty sure now, to move and mobilize the crowd, they had bullhorns, and they had some guy with like a DeWalt sound system strapped to his hip. We see him in one of the pictures that my wife took, and that sound system would be playing speeches by Donald Trump, right? Would be playing, and I can't remember. I don't remember like how incendiary they were, but it was about the injustice of all the, you know, it was the usual Trump boilerplate on this stuff. But they would, you know, they were standing there basically like to draw the crowd. And at one point, they were trying to get more people in. And so the people were congregated on the center steps that go to the rotunda in the back of the Capitol. And they were trying to get them over to the steps that led into the House chamber. And so somebody on the bullhorn announced, like, there's a door open. We've got a door open. Come on in. And the crowd wasn't moving. Like, people weren't moving. And then the guy with the speaker, I'm not sure if it was specifically him or someone else with a sound system, began playing the speech of Trump over at the other stairs. And the crowd starts moving. Like it was like the Pied Piper, right? Using that speech of Trump to try to draw people over. And the only thing that stopped it, like what kept people more, you know, people from starting to go over there, like some people did go over there and others started to move, but then like somebody burst through the doors in the middle and said they shot a girl. And that was after Ashley Babbitt had been shot, and they announced that. Mm-hmm. And then the whole crowd turns around and looks at that, and then people are having their own conversations after that, and they didn't go over to the other, you know, to the stairs to the House chamber. But it was clearly like being orchestrated.
But Terry, you're bringing me to my point, which I wanted to share with both you and the senator, is the Stanley Milgram experiment. He was a Yale psychologist, right, and he did it in 1961 after the World War II Nuremberg war criminal trials, because the people who were being tried, especially Adolf Eichmann, were saying that they were just following orders. They were just being obedient.
Right, right, right.
And he found that...
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. That right. In his study, which we wouldn't be able to do now, thanks to right. Do No Harm, but they had the ability to apply 15 volts up to 450 volts, with that being danger higher, higher, higher. And 2/3 of the participants did the 450 volts, and all of them did 300 volts. Because somebody in authority kept prodding them along. And right. I can't help but think that that's, or the, they call it the obedience alibi.
That right, yeah.
If you're in an agentic state, which means you take on something because you see yourself as an agent for carrying out another person's wishes. So right. I can't help but think that those two psychological theories and constructs are also at play here.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Well, I don't doubt that at all. I mean, what we've seen everything with the, you know, with all the people now saying Trump told us to do it, and even they're in the chamber saying, you know, we're here because your boss told us to be here. Trump's here. Trump right. told us to be here. He's your boss. Get in line, you know.
Right.
Well, you know, given that, one thing that I'd like to ask you as a college professor, during the 1960s. And early 1970s, I was involved in a lot of protests. I went to the University of Maryland College Park. It was a very active campus. We were involved in things down on the mall and around the White House, protesting the war. But we were all about, let's all get together and love each other. Let love, you know, let's fight hate with love. I talk to young people now, my daughters, for example, and they're not, you know, they're, one of them just graduated from college. One's been out about 5 years. And they're like, no, hell no, Dad. We don't want to bring everybody together. We want to stand up to these people. Do you notice a difference in young, in your students? Do your students want to make a fight out of this, do you think, as well as the people on the other side?
I mean, it's hard. It's hard in that we've been online since March. So the real ratcheting up of things, I haven't, you know, right now, I don't have a point of reference for that because we don't see the students. But my sense of it before that was that there's a real intolerance of intolerance, right? Increasing. Like, people are just like, nope, we're not doing that anymore. Like, nope, you're not, you know, I mean, my sense of this generation, from what I've seen, is that they're much more tolerant. There's an expectation of tolerance, and they're not going to sit quietly while, if someone's doing something they consider beyond the pale, if they're a bigot or whatever. And I think, you know, I think what it is that, I mean, and then, you know, that's the whole complaint on the right about cancel culture, right? We're saying and doing these things, but now there's consequences. Well, yeah, I mean, right? I mean, and I think part of that is one of the, you know, I think positive effects of social media in terms of preserving and enforcing civil society and a civil culture that, you know, we know a lot of this violence and a lot of hate groups organize on social media. And so it's been pretty clearly vilified for that. And rightly, I mean, they've certainly been made some pretty big mistakes, I think, as far as letting a lot of this ramp up and get out of control and their algorithms, you know, just ginning up more and more hate by the terms of things that they direct to people's sites. But by the same token, social media has been an incredible place for people to organize and for people to be seen and to be humanized. That they're, you know, if you've got a phone, you know, like think about all of the Black Lives Matter and police brutality that's been, you know, this. If people didn't have a phone, there'd be a lot of white people would just hear a story and be like, yeah, well, I'm sure they did something wrong or whatever. But then when you see video of that, you can't say that. You know, if you see that George Floyd video, you can't say that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think I think the video, the viral nature of video, the ability to hold people who do you know, who are bigoted and to have consequences for them, I think is really important and in terms of changing culture and changing society to be more tolerant. And if in some ways more tolerant also means more intolerant of intolerance, and that people are saying, no, you're not going to be like that. And if you want to be like that, you're not going to be like that around us. I think that's maybe what the thing that you were describing about, no, we don't, we want to stand up against that. I think what you're seeing is particularly a lot of white people and white kids standing up for other, you know, standing up and beside other kinds of people, you know, who are different than them, of a different race or a different ethnicity or a different religion. And I do think they are coming together. I don't think it's like, I think they're just, there's one side that's like, we're going to be a pluralistic civil society that's going to be democratic, and we're going to try to, you know, like, we're going to try to make this work and make it authentic, you know. And I think there's another, you know, minority of this country that's frightened of that, that doesn't want that, that sees that as them losing power, that sees that as them losing status and standing. So I wouldn't say that one, you know, I do see a lot of, like, I see, you go to some of these protests on like, even Black Lives Matter protests, we went to a couple of those, and there was, you know, people were talking, and, you know, there were lots of different people. Everybody was very friendly, you know, very, very nice. There was anger there, but there was a sense of camaraderie as well that went across racial lines. So I think, you know, I think that there's changes happening, and we're not changing back. And I think that's the thing that the younger generations realize, that they're not going to accept what their parents or grandparents had been willing to tolerate. And because they're doing it en masse and they're enforcing it en masse and they're using social media to enforce it and out people, I think that that's a powerful challenge to white supremacy and to white privilege. And so people are upset, they're upset about it. But it's very revolutionary, I must say. I must tell you, it's very patriotic. Cancel culture like that, or whatever they call cancel culture, the social shunning to enforce cultural mores, that's how the revolution was formed, right? That's exactly what the patriots did in 1765 to 1776, right? If somebody was going to break a boycott or speak out in favor of the British or help the British out, you know, you'd shun them. They would be... You know, if somebody's going to take up the office of a stamp collector, we're all going to pretend they don't exist anymore. We're not going to have fellowship with them. We're not going to do business with them. We're going to treat them as if they are a non-person. And that was pretty effective as a tool of enforcing social values and norms. I mean, yeah, and can that be bad and also used in different kinds of ways to uphold racism and the rest of it? Yeah, and had it been for most of American history used in that way? Yes. But this is a different, I think this is a kind of different thing, right? It is a different goal, and the goal is for a more inclusive society. And I find that really refreshing and pretty inspiring, because I think that's the future. That's the side that wins. We're going to have to go through a hell of a lot of bad stuff, and I think there's going to be a lot of violence. How collective it gets, and how, you know, like these militia groups, we're going to end up with like a Waco or another kind of, you know, Ruby Ridge, yeah. Like some kind of standoff as, you know, as these groups are investigated and prosecuted as terrorist organizations. I don't see how we avoid that.
Well, I have to ask you this question. In reading the title of your book, The People, the Founders, and the Troubled Ending of the American Revolution, I want to ask you if you can quickly tell me what was the trouble with ending the revolution? I always thought, you know, that it ended well for the colonists. Is that not the case?
Well, I mean, look, here's the big story. So, after the French and Indian War, and the story runs from the 1760s and 70s to the post-war period, 1780s and 90s. And in the 1760s and 70s, Britain was trying to make the colonies more profitable and to get them to bear a share of their own administration after the hugely expensive French and Indian War, which for Britain was also a world war. And so they enacted all of these policies, like they eliminated the colony's ability to print paper money, they started taxing in gold and silver, and they ended up shutting down their trade, which is they had most of that was smuggling, like technically illegal smuggling, which was how the only way that the colonies could get gold and silver. And so Britain enacted all of these policies, and they shut down the American economy, and people started being foreclosed left and right. And they saw the British policies as oppressive, and they protested against them. And then Britain, you know, would rescind a policy but send more troops. And then they'd protest again. The next policies that came around, they would rescind the policy but send more troops. And so eventually we have an independence movement. After the war, and everybody's sort of roughly on the same page in thinking that Britain is oppressive and they have enacted these impressive economic policies, right? They eliminated our paper money and they taxed us on gold and silver, and we didn't have gold and silver, and they drove our economy into the ground. And after the war, what happens is once we obtain independence, a lot of the founding elite, start enacting the same policies that they basically, without Britain there, start to enact policies that were beneficial for affluent creditors like themselves. They were trying to create an economy that worked really well for them, but not so well for the rest of folks. So they eliminated paper money once again, started enacting taxes on gold and silver, just like Britain, and the result was just a sort of devastated economy. And many ordinary Americans were like, didn't we just live through this? Didn't we just do this one? And we know about, like, the so-called Shays Rebellion version of that, but I was writing about what happened in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania had been described as being, you know, very prosperous and politically content in the post-war period in the 1780s and 90s. And I was going through and finding that in some of these places in western Pennsylvania over a decade, about 40% of the population had been foreclosed. Like, the economy was terrible, so bad that people were being foreclosed left and right, losing their farms and horses and the rest of it. And then so they were trying to find ways collectively to get together, but they didn't have a good way of communication or coordination. And most of them were so convinced that the kinds of protests that they had used against Britain, right, the kind of political violence that they had used against Britain would save the day for them, right, just like it had against Britain, because that kind of collective violence had worked real well against Britain. But that was because everybody was on the same page, right, and viewed Britain as an occupying force and the rest of it. Well, now they try to do these same protests against the new United States, and they get cracked down on. They don't have a way of they don't do a very good job of finding networks and communicating with other people to recruit more people in. And instead, they basically wall themselves off. They try to, like, isolate their communities and keep the world from coming into them. And they don't even vote. like the voting turnout is terrible. And so they lose power. They lose their farms. And they rise up in this misguided rebellion. You know, rather than turning to electoral politics and using that to try to get themselves out of this hole, they resort to armed force and they get crushed, which is
part of our
same
problem.
Same thing that's going to happen here. I think it's the same thing we're going to see here. Like, these folks want to rise up like that, they will eventually get crushed. That there will be enough overwhelming federal force used against them that they're not going to. You know, they're going to get outgunned, and I don't even think most of them have taste for fighting. There are a lot of parallels there. And what happened afterward in Pennsylvania was they stopped voting, right? They stopped doing anything. They just disengaged and were despondent and didn't didn't really vote for a while until eventually they, you know, a lot of them became Jeffersonians. But
of course,
you can see the same thing here. These people backing out of politics after if Trump's gone and this stuff is, they've got, you know, their dream, their QAnon dream dies. You know, what do they do? Do they vote for the Republicans? Do they vote at all?
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Professor, and we so appreciate you coming. We're running out of time here, and we so appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your perspective. I hope we can come you, we can have you back again. We can have you come back again when we learn a little more. I think we're going to learn a lot more in the next few weeks about some of the things,
yeah,
that you brought up. So thank you very much for being on the show.
And when will your next book be published, the Foreign Founders book? Is that coming soon?
Yeah, no, that one's got a little delayed. I had both my parents have Alzheimer's, and I was taking care of my mom for a number of years. We're getting back. We're back in the swing of things now. So
When you launch the book, please come back so we can talk
promote it. Exactly.
You got it. We'll do it.
All right.
Thank you
for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, we're going to inaugurate a new I'm cutting our guests off a few minutes early tonight because we're going to have an inauguration of a new president on Wednesday. And I just want to remind everybody, tomorrow is when we celebrate Dr. King's birthday. And I want everybody to keep in mind that King said that hate begets hate, violence begets violence. Toughness begets a greater toughness. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. And I'd like to end the show tonight with, that statement. And
nonviolence.
Right, and nonviolence.
Peaceful protests.
So tonight we leave you. Thank you, Maria, and thank you, Dr. Boughton. Tonight we leave you with a song about Dr. King. Let's celebrate what he stood for this week. Maria, last word yours.
As always, we want to thank our listeners. We really appreciate it. We know you have lots of opportunities and choices out there, and the fact that you keep landing on Shadow Politics on BBS Radio makes us super proud.